Jesus, the guy can't even wear it in the vehicle.
If members will recall, the question of where the interest portion of the Dinkle Sands money went is one which could be clarified by legislation. There was a memorandum sent around to all of you with two potential bill drafts for introduction by the Senate Finance Committee, one of which said that the interest should be deposited into the budget reserve account, and the other interest, let's see, the second draft requires revenue to account for interest separately and notify the legislature so it could be appropriated to any location, essentially where the legislature wants to appropriate. But that original Tam Cook opinion said essentially that the interest can't legally be in the principal under current law. It should have gone under current law to the reserve account. I don't know if members are familiar with all that. Anyway, that's a question. And the question I would have is, we have a request to introduce a bill. Which draft would the members prefer?
I said draft one. It's my preference.
Shall be deposited into the budget reserve.
Well, I don't think what makes a difference if we can debate the thing after it gets in, as far as we're going to do it. Yeah. Draft two is not all that bad either.
No, draft two is pretty good, because you can, Mr. Chairman, you can still appropriate the interest on it.
Well, draft two gives you more flexibility. Brings it back to the legislative debate each year, is what it does. It's what you put it into reserve fund or somewhere else. Draft one just doesn't.
Puts it in the budget reserve, which is available.
Yeah, which is available.
That's what you have.
Okay, you want to introduce draft one? Okay, that takes care of that. The first bill we had up was Senate Bill 498, Inoculating the Lead in Public Water Systems. Have anybody signed up to testify? Good. Maybe nobody cares.
Why are we dealing with it?
Zero fiscal note, and department supports it, right?
Well, we do have Amy Kyle from DEC. She can explain it anyway. Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Safe Drinking Water Act was amended by the federal Congress a year and a half ago, and one of the new provisions is one that requires that lead solders and fluxes be banned in public water systems. And the reason for that is because the federal EPA has found that the main source of lead in drinking water is from leaching of lead out of fluxes and solders. There's very little lead in natural raw water. And even very low levels of lead are harmful, especially to babies, fetuses, and small children. And so nationally, states are banning use of lead solders and fluxes to avoid repeating these problems in the future. This bill would do this in Alaska. There are alternate solders made of tin and antimony that are readily available. And this bill would do this. One other issue of interest is that I noticed that HUD last week announced that they would not finance any more housing in which lead solders and fluxes were being used. The second section of this bill puts into statute a requirement that already exists for the state to work with public water systems to notify consumers of lead or potential lead levels in public water. So that's what this bill would do. The first portion of it applies to the Department of Labor statute, because they are responsible for implementing a plumbing code statewide. The second part applies to DEC statute, and both agencies have provided zero fiscal notes.
What's the definition of a public water system?
Public water system is one that serves basically more than two households.
That doesn't include any business that's open to the public.
It could include a business if it serves water to people. Yeah, a restaurant, for instance, would have to have a public water system.
So a public water system is essentially a water system and anything that's open to the public.
That's basically correct.
If it has a water system.
That's basically correct.
Could that be a service station?
I don't believe that a service station is covered, but I would have to check that. I'm not certain about that.
The notification requirements, it says shall notify persons, so it's mandatory, shall notify, who may be affected. I'm trying to figure out what this really means. If the drinking water, if the contamination, or if there is contamination, results from lead content in construction materials, or the corrosivity of the water supply. I'm trying to figure out what that all means. I mean, who's going to have to be notified when?
Mr. Chairman, this language was taken from the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act and incorporated by the drafter for the Labor and Commerce Committee. So what they basically did is just put the federal language in here, which may be why it's hard to understand. What the intent of the federal notice is for public drinking water systems to notify people if there's some possibility that their water could be contaminated by lead, either as a result of high corrosivity or use of lead construction materials in the water system. And we are working with the water systems to reasonably implement this. The federal language was not, you know, written directly for Alaska, and so we're working to identify the systems that need to do this and help them figure out how best to do it right now.
But you're going to be down to every business that has anything to do with water and public use with this section. The first section is all prospective.
Correct.
The second section deals with everything existing today. And I'm just concerned that we're going to end up with a decal in every place that has any water, since there may be lead in the water. Or I don't know what business is supposed to do. You don't seem like you have an answer either.
Well, as I say, this is language from the federal law, and we are working with the water system to figure out how reasonably to implement it in Alaska. From the perspective of our agency, it's not necessary to have this section in the statute. That's it's not something that's necessary from our perspective. We're working on implementing this part of the federal law in any case, and it was something included by the drafter for Labor and Commerce, and so that's our perspective on it. We are working with EPA to reasonably implement it in this state, and yes, I understand exactly what you mean. It's more geared toward larger water systems than we tend to have up here. And so what we're trying to do is work with the bigger water systems to actually mail notices to consumers and then figure out something that's reasonable for the little ones. And that affects both villages and businesses. Both of them may have some pretty small water systems that don't have an easily available means of notifying individual consumers.
Well, I wonder if there's some way to deal with that in the definition of what a public water system is. Because, you know, our definition is so broad that essentially this covers, you know, thousands of entities which have a, quote, public water system by definition. And I wonder if there's any way you can refer to a public water system in a little different manner that covers the big ones and not all over.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have three classes. We have Class A, B, and C water systems. Class C are the little ones, the businesses and so on. Potentially, one could refer to Class A and B systems in the statute. That might be one approach.
Okay, what's the definition of Class A?
Class A systems serve greater than, I believe, 200 people, and Class B systems regularly serve greater than 25, as I recall. And then Class C are most of the business and transient systems that aren't serving subscribing users.
Like a motel?
Right. Most of them would be.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I was just getting tuned in here now. Did you say that, Amy, that the last section, Section 3, really isn't what you are really after? That's not really the most important thing to you? The department doesn't necessarily need that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, from the perspective of the department, we did not, we don't feel that this needs to be in the statute.
Okay. That's fine. That seems to be where your concern is, Mr. Chairman. I suggest we take Section 3 out and move the bill.
Comments by other members of the committee?
Is that okay?
That would be fine.
Yeah, that is where my concern is. I would like to ask the sponsor before we do that.
Yeah.
Who's the sponsor?
Senator Kelly. It was introduced by Labor and Commerce, but I think Senator Kelly is the senator.
Okay, well, fine.
Why don't we just hold this and we'll check and see. We might come back to it still today. Thank you very much.
I'm just trying to get things off there, sir.
Department of Safety, Public Safety's ability to enter into contracts. See, we have a couple of zero pistol notes. Three due passes out of state of Bears.
I'm from Public Safety, and I'm here to answer any questions on that if need be.
Okay, you Mike Lewis?
Yes, sir.
Would you join us at the table? Just tell us what the bill is for, and
Primarily, first I'll start out. My name is Mike Lewis. I'm with the Highway Safety Agency of Department of Public Safety. And under Highway Safety, we give grants to state and local agencies and also to private nonprofit agencies to conduct highway safety type of projects. Currently, the department does not have authority to give grants directly to private nonprofits. And for that matter, we don't, or to local governmental units. Therefore, what we have to do is go through the contract process. And if you've ever gone through the contract process, you're talking about several months worth of work and several inches worth of paperwork. This would allow us to give grants directly to these agencies to perform functions that does not directly benefit us, but it does benefit the public. And these grants, this authority could also extend into the contract jails, which is a legislative type thing that it would eliminate quite a bit of paperwork if they could just negotiate a project with the cities rather than go through the contract process. It would eliminate quite a bit of paperwork and also a lot of time delay. So all we're seeking here is just authority to give grants.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Hensley, could you give us some examples of the kind of grants that you're talking about?
Yes, sir. Currently, I have a project with the Alaska Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. And what it is, it's a three-year contract. They go into the schools and they do all types of alcohol prevention and seatbelt prevention type of things with the schools from all ages, from preschool level up to high school. Friday Night Live program, drinking, driving, and deciding, and those type of programs. They work with the schools statewide, and I fund this through federal funds that's received through the Highway Safety Agency. But to pass those funds on to the Alaska Council, currently I have to contract with it. And like I say, a contract for them is about that thick. So that's one of the type of things. With the city of Homer, we currently have a seatbelt project with them, a seatbelt challenge. We have to contract with them rather than give a grant directly. So those are the type of projects we have currently.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. Are you saying that you have to operate through the procurement code to get these services?
Yes, sir.
And so are we amending the procurement code to do this? Is that what we're doing?
No, so what we're doing is seeking the same type of authority that Health and Social Services have under EMS, just to allow us to give grants directly without going through the contractual procedures that most states do this under the Highway Safety Program anyway.
This isn't any authority that the other departments don't have, or what departments have this or don't have?
Well, Health and Social Services has it, Department of Administration has it, Public Safety has it under Fire Prevention and under Domestic Violence. But those are within the statutes that set up those agencies particularly. But Public Safety does not have it on a total. Therefore, contract jails, Civil Air Patrol, Highway Safety, all these type of things have to go through the contractual process, and it would eliminate a lot of paperwork and a lot of time by being able just to grant grants directly.
Mr. Chairman, is this the only bill that's been introduced then in the legislature?
Yes.
Okay.
Further questions by members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dutton?
I'd move that we report out of committee for May 5th, which is in bill number 179.
Are there objections to reporting out committee subject to Senate Bill 174 with 2-0 fiscal amendments and individual recommendations? Without objections, so ordered.
This is a good one to kill.
We go back to issue 198.
Yeah.
The sponsor does not mind if we delete section 3.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman.
I'd move that we prepare Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 174, deleting section. Oh, that's not 174.
498.
Deleting section 3 and renumbered sections.
We have a motion to delete section 3 in Finance CS and renumber accordingly. Are there objections? Without objection, we'll draft the Finance CS without section 3. Further discussion on Senate Bill 498?
I move the bill.
We have a motion to move Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 498. Zero fiscal notes, individual recommendations. Are there objections? Without objection, Senate Bill 498, Finance, is out of committee.
Is this your bill?
384, validity of regulations, presumption. Oh, it's got a fiscal note.
Well, you zeroed it out.
Oh, that's good.
Most appropriately, you zeroed it out.
Zero.
Okay, Senate Bill 384. Senator Hensley.
I move the bill, Mr. Chairman. Well,
I object for purposes of explanation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, these recommendations basically come from the Model State Administrative Procedure Act, and it started out as a fairly lengthy bill, but we've reduced it basically by requiring governor's signature on, or approval of regulations that are issued under the auspices of each of his departments. And that would, Mr. Chairman, provide for accountability of agency regulatory and rulemaking powers to the chief elected official in the executive branch. Also provide consistency between agencies with overlap or tangential regulatory authorities, and increase the ability of the executive to affect or direct policy to agency regulatory authorities. Section 3 simply provides that the public announcements of proposed regulatory changes are more descriptive and more understandable as to the proposal's intended effect. Basically, trying to explain in layman's language what the regulations propose to do.
What's the, Mr. Chairman, what's the thesis of this? I mean, what are we doing in Section 2 here? Are we trying to tighten up that there has to be a signature on regulations or changes to regulations?
Exactly right. The governor would have to approve. Mr. Chairman, I've had Dave, we had a fairly lengthy analysis done during the interim of this whole process of rulemaking and regulations, and if you have any questions, Dave Gray is here to help you with them.
I do have a question on Section 2. We're exempting out the last Public Offices Commission.
Yes.
Some of those people.
We did. We had, in fact, we had a rather lengthy list of proposed agencies to exempt, but for instance, we decided to stay out of the arena of, say, fish, game regulations, for instance. And APOC, since the governor is also subject to those APOC regulations, we figured that maybe he should not.
It's interesting to have APOC that's regulating the people who are public officers, but on the same hand, they have their sort of own independent autonomy there to do whatever they want on regulations. I mean, that's what we run into problems when we have. And we want to change the regulations over there. Let's put all these regulations in that we have to comply with. I guess we can just do that separately.
Well, my preference would be to keep them all in, but we were trying to.
I think I see your point, though, on the fact that.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the governor's office, or no one took a position on the legislation. I see fiscal note, but I don't see any. Do they think this is a good idea, bad idea?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the Chief of Staff thinks it's a good idea. They would like to have a body, but that's the only issue that I aware of.
Further questions? Discussion? We have drafted a zero fiscal note. What is the pleasure of the committee with regard to the fiscal note first?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that the governor's office has enough people, that somebody there surely has. I mean, he does have special assistants that cover these various agencies, and I would suspect that they would surely have time to take a look at these regulations. I'm sure they wouldn't object to having additional people there, but if they're not here begging for it, perhaps it's something that they can.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that they would review those regulations anyhow before they come out, and it's his employees that are proposing. Proposing the regulations, so I don't see why they need another person to
look
at it a second time.
Okay. Is it the will of the committee that we adopt the zero fiscal note of this bill?
Yes.
It appears to be. Do we have a motion to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 384 Judiciary be moved out with individual recommendations with the zero fiscal note.
Are there objections to moving 384 zero fiscal note individual recommendations? Without objection, so ordered.
She's just a lively crowd. How come you guys lost yesterday?
That's why no one's here.
That's the last bill on our schedule for this morning.
Great.
Yeah, how come you guys spread this out so you, I don't even room to sign?
What we're paying you guys for anyway, win those basketball games.
It's stealing it. Uses up two or three lines. Okay. This week, we've got to get a reappropriation list together, whether it's on our bill or House bill. We've got to have that stuff together, so let's be sure we've got it in.
No problem.
Tonight. Because I'm going to essentially put together all that we've got, and if it's not in, it doesn't go. Capital budget. We're going to have $4.98 for each district, and everybody should be working on their list.
You mean 4.9 million?
Can we move the decimal?
Move it to
about four places to write.
Take more than that.
We also have to have a hearing on the proposed loan budget. So yeah, we're going to add those things. John's going to start working on the reappropriations on the supplemental bill. But we're going to add those things to this week's calendar and try to get the bills we've got there out. Plus, we'll be adding other bills, too, to get them going. Tomorrow, if there is an objection, I'd like to add that the SBS bill that came over from the House. We'll get that out. But let's just start picking up things as fast as we can to go.
How about if we start meeting at 1:30 to try and pick up some of these other things, like supplementals? I'd like to start having hearings on supplementals maybe by Wednesday. At 1:30 in the afternoon.
Jim, I'd like, I don't mind that, but for some of us who have more than one committee to meet causes problems. We got resources. If you can talk, it's three of us.
I would like to.
This side of the table all has
and
resources.
Also, what about Tuesday afternoon?
Tuesdays are fine for me.
Tuesdays
and Thursdays are fine.
Tomorrow.
Okay. We'll have a meeting tomorrow afternoon at 1:30. Then that's up.
Yeah, Tuesdays and Thursdays are great.
What are we doing tomorrow morning? Tomorrow morning we got bills up and we're going to try and add a few if we can. Trying to add that one House bill. Now we've got, tomorrow morning we've got ag stuff again. I still haven't got answers to the questions we've asked. And my inclination is if we don't get answers, we hold off on the bill. What's the attitude of the committee?
Here.
I think that's something we could
idea. We've already got one ag bill passed this year, didn't we?
Yeah.
On the mats, on the dairy.
That's right.
Which, that you know, it's a big plus for people out there, I think.
Yeah. Sure.
What do they want?
Everything.
More money, everything.
Free land.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with some of you. I think we passed an ag bill. One of those a year.
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have the tolerance of the committee to try one more time.
Well,
but only if they come up with the information.
I'd like to look at that production tax.
Are they against it or for it?
I thought we moved it out and it was on someone's desk and then we didn't move it out, so I don't know where it really is now. So I don't know how that's.
We brought it back to the committee. We rescinded our action moving it out. After we heard what they were doing, we brought all the bills back and held on to them.
Anyway, we ought to look at that again, I guess.
Okay. We'll have two meetings tomorrow then. Thank you, we're adjourned.
Okay.
I don't have any gum to share with all of them.
Will the Finance Committee please come to order? I'm missing the article, so I guess we better get going. First bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 401, an act relating to repeals of information requests and so on and so forth, alias House Bill 58, Senate Bill 401. Do we have any questions on the legislation? Senator Fakes is here to testify. We've had several hearings on the bill. We have a CS before us. It's been before us for some time. What is the pleasure of the committee? Senator Fakes, do you wish to address the legislation? We do have the Finance CS before us. That's the CS dated 4/25/88. We have section analysis. We have all the parts and pieces.
Mr. Chairman, I missed some of the earlier hearings on this. These fiscal notes that you prepared, has the committee gone over these fiscal notes before?
Fiscal notes, there are five fiscal notes on the legislation. The first fiscal note was income and excise audit. The request was for 491,000 in 5 full-time positions. The Finance Committee fiscal note reduces that to 303 and 4 full-time positions. Oil and gas audit requested 27 full-time positions. The Finance Committee reduced that to 9 full-time positions, and from 2.2 million to 563,000. Commissioner's fiscal note is the same as a zero. It can carry forward 566 and 6 full-time positions in fiscal year 91. Department of Law was included 1372 for outside counsel. That was denied, but it carried forward the request for Department of Law personnel. It deleted the special litigation funds in the courts because the court would be setting up essentially a new court. That fiscal note remains as they requested at 633.7.
What's the bottom line?
Bottom line, I have a total to be better. Let's run the total.
Chairman, are you talking about the fiscal notes you signed or the ones that the departments have signed?
1,238.8 is what I get.
Mr. Chairman, we've got 5 fiscal notes. I've got 4 in front of me. What's the last one that I missed?
The last one, I think, is zero from the Commissioner's office.
Well,
zero this year.
Chairman, I've got about 8 different packets of fiscal notes. Let me ask you, are you talking about the ones you signed or the ones...
I'm talking about the Finance Committee fiscal notes, right.
The ones marked 425.88?
Right.
And would you start through them again, please? Because I don't think I have them all.
Okay. Let's find each individual one.
Okay, the first one, Mr. Chairman, is 303.1.
Right.
The second one is 563.2.
Okay, the 303.1
correct.
Is Revenue, Income, and Excise Audit Division. Right. That's the 303.1. And it's got a second sheet behind it that explains what it does. That's 4 positions instead of 5 positions. Okay, the second one is 563.2, and that's essentially a complete audit team in oil and gas audit. The original request would have added 27 permanent full-time positions, which I assume would have broken out to essentially 3 audit teams. It wasn't broken out. What this is a breakout of one complete audit team, essentially. That's the 563. The third one is the original one, I think, which is the Commissioner's office. Let's see if
I don't think we have that one.
I have the... That is a zero fiscal note this year, I believe.
That was in the original package.
Should be in the original package, that's correct. Okay, that's about 6 back in your file. It looks like this. Zero this year. The fourth one is Law.
Department of Law, 372.5.
Yeah. Okay. That would be the
which.
In which packet?
It was in this packet of these three.
Right. Then how about the I work? And zero fiscal note for the court.
Now, the court system is 633. That's here. Where are we now?
That should be this one here.
We're going to give them what they asked for.
Now, that's the original one, because that creates a new.
That's right there.
That's this one right here.
Right.
That's the 633.7.
Mr. Chair, I have all this.
The total is 1,872,872. That is proposed.
On the court system fiscal note. It says here we need two new Superior Court judges located in Anchorage for $300,000 approximately. Is that what a Superior Court judge costs us, about $150,000 a year?
This is, of course, their fiscal note. I don't know if we have anyone here from the court system that can go over this. I would assume that with benefits, that's correct, if that's what the number they show is. They show no escalation in that number, which is also interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They show two judges, two in-court clerks, two secretaries, two law clerks, two court clerks, two pro tem, Superior Court judges, two more clerks, and two more clerk twos. Contractual supplies and equipment.
16 people.
Analysis, the next page. Assumes that one half of the Department of Revenue's current formal and informal hearing caseload for these tax assessments would enter the court system. The court system would expect to receive 107 cases, majority of 90 and 91. And 25 cases a year thereafter. Each judge could hear 7.5 cases a year. That lays it out pretty completely.
7.5 cases per year?
Well, they're looking at estimated 5 weeks of trial per case. Expected to take 4 to 8 weeks, so they average at 5 and ran from there.
So that's about 37 weeks of work. Is that about what they put in a year? Chairman, I'm curious to know, of course, they're expecting to hire these judges in fiscal year 89, which would start July 1st, I guess, and all the other 14 positions, support positions for the judges. You know, we've heard a lot of testimony earlier about how overcrowded they are in the
current building, and how they really have absolutely no room for any more people in that facility, and how even records are not being able to be stored there, how they're going to fit these 16 people, including two new judges, which of course are going to need chambers to hear these cases, how they're going to do this in fiscal year 89, starting July 1st, just 2 months away from now.
You're asking me the question, Senator Benson.
I'd just soon be asking Mr. Snowden, but I would see him at the end of the table.
I don't think he's going to be in town for the rest of the year. I don't know. Maybe they'll use it for doing the arson.
No space rent?
There's no space rent. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to say on the fiscal note question, and I think Senator Mickey may have had a good question. I would assume that if this legislation passes, that perhaps he can find the answer to those questions before the fiscal notes are finally inserted in the budget, and if it's necessary to reduce the court system fiscal note at that time, you could do that. You can always reduce fiscal notes.
You could increase the size of the building.
You can even zero the amount you need to. I mean, that's something you can always take care of down the line.
Has the CS been adopted?
No. Mr. Chairman, I would move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 401.
We have a motion to adopt the proposed Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 401. That is the draft 42588. The number at the top is 5-1449T. Does everyone have that in the file? Are there objections to adopting the Finance Committee substitute? Without objection, the Finance Committee substitute is adopted. What is the pleasure of the committee on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator Bing.
I'd like to suggest to the Finance Committee that for fiscal year 89, at least for the court system, proposed fiscal note that we reduce that by half and just have one team of Superior Court judges to handle some of the proposed cases that may come before them in fiscal year 89. So that would mean cutting all those positions in half. One Superior Court judge, one in-court clerk, one secretary, one law clerk, one court clerk two, one pro tem Superior Court judge, one in-court clerk, and one court clerk two again. So that we do, oh, excuse me, no, that would actually just go down through the Let me start over again. Be one Superior Court judge, one in-court clerk, one secretary, one law clerk, and one additional court clerk two, instead of the proposed two positions for all of those categories.
Okay, that would go down to 316, or 316.7, something like that.
Now let's see what would be here. You'd save about 290,000, 290.6 thousand.
Okay.
I assume then that.
Are you having the fiscal note across the board?
Yes, for FY89.
Okay, that would take out essentially half the personnel, half the contractual, half the supplies, and half the equipment.
Correct.
Okay, and half the entire fiscal note. That would come out about 316.8.
Right.
Okay. I have no objection to that. What's the pleasure of the committee?
I don't have that objection.
Okay, if there isn't any objection to that, we will reduce the court system fiscal note to 316.8 and the personnel and costs contained therein to reflect that.
Mr. Chairman, what's the purpose of that?
What is the purpose of the court system's
the
fiscal note or
fiscal
the reduction?
Note. I mean, I don't have an objection to reducing it, but I mean, are we going to reduce all the fiscal notes?
Well, I think in the case of the, Mr. Chairman, in the case of the court system, I think that if these cases are litigated, I can't imagine that by July 1st they're going to need two Superior Court judges, that the influx of cases is going to be so rapid that they're going to have to have two Superior Court judges and all the associated support personnel in place July 1 to start hearing these cases. At least for the first year, they will be able to phase in with just one additional Superior Court judge and all the support staff by the time it gets to the actual hearing of cases before the judges.
Senator Fisher, I'm just... Further questions? We've reduced the court system fiscal note to 316.8.
Motion back.
Do we have a motion to move the bill with the fiscal notes, including the amended court system fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we pass out the substitute for Senate Bill number 401 with the five fiscal notes and the new fiscal note sponsored by Senator Binkley with the changes in the court system.
Are there objections?
That was just, Mr. Chairman. Just a point of clarification. It was just a suggestion to the committee.
Well, I think it's a good one.
Okay.
I mean, if we really wanted, we could reduce them all by half.
I was really sponsoring that fiscal note in the court system. Just wanted to make that clear.
I think that's a good suggestion.
Are there objections to moving out the bill with the Binkley fiscal note and the others? Without objection, the bill's out of committee with the fiscal notes as discussed in the Finance CS.
I want to thank the, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank the committee for working very hard on this work session on Friday, coming up with a bill that is very good.
Who said it was very good? No editorial comments.
The next bill on our agenda is House Bill 93.
Oh, no. What's this one? This is a quick one. You guys are ready. Heard this, haven't you?
Actually, we don't. Hope we don't get the research issues on this.
This bill has a thick pile.
You guys are
finance.
We're just going to have to
deal with
it.
You've heard it. They've heard it. I've heard it.
Okay. Let's just do this. Let's get back to where we have one person here that would like to testify on Senate CS for House Bill 93 Finance. That's Mary Grisco from Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mary Grisco. I'm here for the Susitna Valley Association. I won't take much of your time because I know this bill has been through a lot. I just want to again remind you that the Susitna Valley Association is very concerned about there being no commercial logging permitted within the recreational river corridors. The association is a broad-based group of users and others for the Rec River area. We're convinced that the use is currently within the valley that includes logging for personal use, and others are not compatible with commercial logging. We also appreciate the addition of the private landowner to the list of users.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Senator Hanson,
do you support the bill?
Do we support the bill? We've gone on record, if you've read our position paper, of supporting it as long as there's no commercial logging allowed within the access corridors.
How about the, okay, well, the bill provides for...
personal use logging.
Well, it also provides that if there is a crossing of a corridor that is approved for another purpose, they can, under 3805.115, commercially permit the removal of trees in that corridor. So that's the exception to the commercial logging ban in the charters.
Right.
I just want to make sure you understood that.
Yes.
And that's in the fiscal note. I mean, excuse me, in the letter.
Well, it's in the bill and in the letter. Okay.
I would also urge that that the fiscal note provide adequate funding for the management planning that's spoken about within the bill, too.
If there are any questions, thank you.
Thank you.
For the members' benefit, there are two changes in the finance CS, both of which have been checked with the resources chair and the sponsor of the bill. First one appears on page 4, and to the advisory board, it adds the requirement that there be members representing the following groups, and it lists these 11 groups, and one of it adds the group private property owners within the Recreation River Charter. And on page 7, it adds the word only with regard to timber sales and material sales. So the previous version said the commissioner may conduct a negotiated timber sale or material sale under 3805-15 for personal use, house logs, firewood, or use incidental to construction of access or for habitat enhancement. It adds the word only to clarify that that is the only reason for timber or material sales. And in the letter of intent, which is...
What is that?
Further clarifies that. Let me find it.
Yep. Good. Yeah.
Letter of intent further clarifies that same point. I think most of the committee members have already heard this bill. So if we have a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 93, Finance.
I have a motion to adopt the CS. Are there objections? Without objections, the Finance Committee substitute has been adopted. Okay, letter of intent. Do we have a motion to adopt the letter of intent?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll move we adopt the letter of intent. That's one paragraph, one that you haven't signed yet.
Okay, we have a letter of intent. Are there objections to the adoption of the letter of intent? Without objections, the letter of intent is adopted. We have the bill before us with the fiscal note of $123,136,000. Do we have a motion to move the bill?
Chairman, I'd move that we report out a committee, Finance Committee substitute for, Senate Finance Committee substitute for House Bill number 93.
I have a motion to move out Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 93 with $136,000 fiscal note. Are there objections?
And the letter of intent.
And the letter of intent.
Would include that motion.
Without objection, the bill is moved out of committee. The next bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 285.
Is it a big deal?
285.
Leave the district
court, sir. What's
it do?
Okay. We have,
let's see.
Go ahead and ask to testify on the leave for district court judges.
I'm Lynn Asper. I'm the Juneau District Court Judge. I sense that this may not be the best time for a judge to appear before you. Hopefully this measure is less controversial than others you've considered. Basically a record-keeping or bookkeeping change in leave system so that the district court judges of the state would be on the same leave system as the superior court judges and other appointed judges in the state. It's supported by the court system because it unifies the leave system and would reduce administrative costs. It carries a zero fiscal note, I believe, and it's supported by the district court judges who asked me to appear today because it trades short-term gains in personal leave for long-term gains in sick leave and security derived from that system. And also it would lead to a uniform system, which the district court judges favor, because more and more over the passing years, the district court judges and the superior court judges, the trial court judges of the state, tend to be assuming the same functions. So the distinction between the two kinds of judges are blurred with the increases in jurisdiction that the legislature has granted to the district court, and with the increased use of district court judges as pro tem or temporary superior court judges. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that there might be from the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yulee.
What we're doing here then is just granting district court judges the leave, the same leave that other judges
have already had. The same leave system that all the other appointed judges of the state have.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glenn, you mentioned in your opening statement that this would reduce administrative costs. Should I see a zero fiscal note? If this would reduce administrative costs, shouldn't there actually be a savings reflected in the fiscal note?
Internally, I'm not sure. Frankly, I don't know how fiscal notes, well, I know a little bit about fiscal notes because I used to work for the legislature, but I don't know how they work vis-a-vis the internal savings that the court system might realize from having to do less paperwork. I don't know how that, but we can, that can be clarified by the court system if you wish.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to have that clarified because, you know, anytime we pass any kind of a statute that, or law that requires any additional paperwork, the agencies are always quick to make us aware of any additional costs that may be associated with that. Yet sometimes they're reluctant to come forward with any savings that might result from legislation that we enact. So I think it's important that if there are administrative costs, that we get the court system to reflect those in the fiscal note and really show us what the savings are, and then we can actually realize those in reduction of their budget through the fiscal note.
I think the difficulty is because you're dealing with leave policies and you don't know who's going to be sick and who's going to use the leave, you can't really tell that to that close a degree whether you're going to gain money or lose money. But it's considered to be a negligible amount, I believe.
Then, Mr. Chairman, then it really, I mean, your statement that it would reduce administrative costs, you're not sure if it will reduce
I'm not sure costs? If the net loss gain over years, if over years there would be a net loss or a net gain.
I see. Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Thank you. What system do the magistrates currently have? Do they have the same leave system as the?
They're classified employees, and they have the same leave that other state employees do.
I see. What is, for instance, a district court judge? How many weeks a year would you normally work with them?
Work?
Yeah.
We're full-time state employees, just like any other judge in the state work. Oh, you mean with leave? We have now we're in the regular classified leave system, and it ranges from 24 days a year to 36 days a year, depending on how long you've worked for the state. The new system would be a 30-day uniform leave and would not allow accumulation. Now we can accumulate the way other state employees can. So we would lose in that area, but the sick leave benefits would be better, so we gain in terms of security in the long run.
I don't know if you were here, Glenn, for this earlier bill, but we were hearing Senate Bill 401, and we were speaking about a fiscal note from the court system regarding the need for two additional Superior Court judges. And when you calculate that out, it actually shows about 35 weeks worth of work that the Superior Court judges would have been handling involving those cases. Is it the same for the district court judges?
Well, They're 52 weeks in a year, and right now, I'd say the average judge gets 6 weeks off of those 52, and that's 46. And then there are holidays and so on. I don't know whether it gets down to what you're talking about or not.
35 weeks.
Well, I suppose it's in the ballpark, but I really don't. I'm not qualified to speak on that or have any background on that. I know how much I work. I work the 52 weeks a year less the leave that I get, which is now 6 weeks.
Okay. Further questions?
Chairman, just one question. You get 6 weeks vacation. Take away the holidays is another week, so that's 7 weeks. And then how many sick days are you allowed a week per year?
None.
None.
I mean, the 6 weeks covers all your leave under the current system.
Mr. Chairman, do the other state employees, they don't start off with the 6 weeks vacation, do they? I don't know how other employees fit into this their state. Does anybody know? You know, Senator Duncan? Well, when they start off with a 2 week vacation, or they start at six right away?
I don't think they don't start at six right away, no, but.
Well, judges, there are people here who are judges don't start off at six either.
They start at six. They work up, they accumulate. They length of service, they get more leave.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just. I think we're reading more into this bill than is actually here, my personal opinion. And maybe if I could just go through it, maybe Lynn did that, but could we just go through it section by section so we can really understand what each section of the bill does? Because I think we're really reading into it more than what is here. Section one, as I understand it, maybe I could ask Lynn to go through it, but I don't know that some of these changes are all that dramatic and earth-shaking, right? I think it's so maybe we can just go through. Section one deals with donated leave, is that correct?
Yes, it just adds the, I used to be a legislative counsel, and it's strictly to conform the laws to the change that would be made. It's strictly a bookkeeping change in the law.
Okay.
And same with section two.
What does that do? Just tell us what section one does.
I think it reflects the change in section three, so that the laws would read uniformly now that section three is going to be renumbered.
Well, you add AS 3923, 10, 7, and 8 in Section 1. Section 1 presently deals with people being able to donate accrued personal or annual
leave. All it does is renumber the section, the subsections. You see that.
Oh, okay. All does it renumber.
Subsections 8 and 9 are struck, and subsections 7 and 8 are added.
So that's not earth-shaking. I mean, that's just housekeeping.
Yeah, but what's the effect of that?
The effect is just to tell you that there's a different numbering system now being used for the law because of Section 3, which is the only thing that really does anything in the bill.
That's what I wanted to get to. I think what we're ending up is we're finding out that this doesn't, and I'm not sure we're going to be reducing administration costs as much. Okay. Section 2, then, what does Section 2 do, Lynn?
The same thing
that
Section 1 does to a different section of the statutes.
Okay. Then Section 3.
Section 3 adds district courts to the scheme for leave that is used by the Supreme Court and the Superior Court and the Court of Appeals. It just adds the word and district to add those judges, the 15 district court judges in the state, to the leave system used by the Supreme Court, Superior Court, Court of Appeals.
Okay. And so that gives you a leave system of 30 days annual leave.
30 days set annual leave.
Instead of 24 to 36 as it presently is, or whatever you say.
Limited accumulation rights.
Okay.
And increased sick leave benefits.
Increased sick leave. So I guess that's what the bill does. It just conforms the district court judges to the rest of the judicial system. I don't believe that you're going to see no great savings in administrative costs, but you're talking about how many district court judges there are. I think we're reading more into this bill than what's really there. I think it's more or less housekeeping, if you want to put it that way, but that's my personal opinion. I just wanted to be sure it was clear that we're not making massive changes in the retirement system for district court judges that I can see, nor are we going to end up with a massive state reduction in administrative costs. It may make it easier for someone who's sitting there to keep records because they're all in conformity, but it doesn't mean that you're able to do away with the position, I don't think.
More like a time savings rather than a money savings.
But that's my opinion.
Senator Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What was the impetus for this? Was the court system administration come forward and request this?
The district court judges meeting in Sitka 2-3 years ago requested that the court system seek this legislative change because we wish to have the same leave system that the other appointed judges in the state have.
Judiciary Committee and the Senate side introduced the bill. I don't, at least that's the way it reflects.
I suppose. I don't know how it actually got to you.
But basically, at the request of the district court judges.
Yes, basically, our request, the district court judges.
So let me make sure I understand this. Currently, you have 30 days of annual leave.
No, currently it varies. We're like other state employees. We start out with 24. If you work for the state for 5 years, you go up to 30. Work for the state for 10 years, you go up to 36. And so it's a varied system. I have 30 days because I worked for the state for eight some years.
I see.
I'll go up to 36. I'll lose from this bill, really, because I'm about to go up to the higher plateau. That is, I'll lose unless I have extended illnesses, in which case this new bill will help me and will help other district court judges.
Mr. Chairman, because it increases then your sick leave?
Yes.
And what is your sick leave currently?
It's included in the personal. It's personal leave. We use it however we wish, for vacation or for being ill.
So your 30 days that you're currently at is your sick leave also?
Yes, right.
So actually, if this bill passed, then you would increase, if you held it your 30 days of annual leave, you would then get an additional how many days of sick leave?
It's not specified.
However many you need?
However many you need.
So if you're sick for a month, you just get a month worth of sick leave?
Right.
And you don't have to use up your annual leave in the process?
Right. In practical terms, if you have an extended illness with a judge, the whole system breaks down. There's immediately a lot of attention focus because your calendar is hanging out there, and you have to bring in acting judges to sit and cover. So, frankly, there have been very few cases of any judges being able to have an extended illness. They are forced to go on to, say, disability retirement if they are really ill, or to resign. So the unlimited sick leave aspect doesn't really factor in very much. Because we have a calendar that's made up 3 or 4 months in advance, and here I'm the only district court judge in Juneau. If I get ill, the system pretty much stops in its tracks.
Mr. Chairman, well, why then, now the magistrates are currently the same as you are?
Yes.
Okay, then why should the district court judges get this increased benefit? Not having to use up annual leave with sick leave, and not the magistrates.
I guess our feeling is that we are judges. We are appointed the same way all the other judges are, and there's a distinction between the magistrates and the appointed judges of the state. And we're doing essentially the same work that the other judges are, rather than that the other magistrates are.
But of course, Mr. Chairman, don't magistrates sometimes do some of the same work that district court judges can handle also?
They can, with permission of a defendant, try a criminal case. There are some magistrates who actually conduct jury trials, so it's possible, but it tends to be limited because most magistrates are in the bush areas. For instance, I serve Haines, Hoonah, Yakutat, and Skagway. There's a magistrate in each of those places, but if the case is anything more than a small claims case or a summary disposition of a misdemeanor case, then I go to those places and I handle those cases.
Mm-hmm. I think, for instance, like in Bethel, we have a Superior Court judge and we have a magistrate. There's no district court
right,
judge
there used
in Bethel.
To be.
And I think that some of those cases the magistrates actually try in place of the district court judge.
It's possible. It's the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. Well, I still am not clear then, you know, why we should single out the district court judges and give them this additional benefit when we don't do the same for magistrates. I don't really see the distinction between those two and why the district court judges should have that increased benefit and not the magistrates.
The district court judges are, like other judges, appointed by the governor. They go through the same screening process as the other trial court judges of the state. They're in the same retirement system. They tend, in recent years, because of budget cutbacks, to be appointed as pro tem judges to act in the higher courts. They tend to be more and more like the other appointed judges in the state rather than more and more like the magistrates who are classified employees, or not classified employees, but are under that same general system and who are not generally attorneys and who do not have the kind of powers conferred on the elected and appointed officials, judges of the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question here. The going back to the leave days, your 24 leave days there is what you're saying?
24 you start with now.
Okay, now those are working days, right?
Right.
Okay, so that represents roughly 20 working days per month. You take out Saturdays and Sundays.
Well, you get 24 working days off a year,
right,
if you start as a district court judge.
But I guess what I'm trying to say here is that you roughly, I mean, I think it averages out per month that you get 20 working days a month.
Yes.
So, you know, so what you're looking at here then is that a person starts off then with about a month and a half, well, or not a month and a half, but a month and a week of actual working days where they're paid by the state. And when you go up to 30 days, you're over a month and a half. When you get to 36 days, you're almost up to 2 months
of leave.
Of leave with full pay, full benefits.
Yes.
Just wanted to clarify that so that when you're talking about 36 days, you're not talking about 36 consecutive days.
You're not count, Mr. Chairman, you're not counting Saturdays and Sundays in that. You're taking 5 days a week times and dividing it into 36, and that's
correct,
what your week is really all about. So it's almost 6.5.
Okay, and then if you have a holiday in there, and that's extended beyond that.
That's a good point.
So,
Mr. Chairman,
well, I still don't quite understand how this isn't going to cost the state more money when we're going to increase the sick leave. I mean, if a judge is sick for a week, it's not going to come off their annual leave as it does now, but we're going to have to pay them full pay for that week that they're sick. And I just can't imagine that that isn't going to increase the cost of the state.
I think what it depends on is what the average longevity of judges is. If their average longevity exceeds 10 years, so their average is now 36 days, then they'll probably be covered in 6 days if you're taking away in the additional sick leave. If their average longevity is shorter than that, there may be a little bit of net loss in actual working days paid. I don't know the answer to that, but I think the amount either side is negligible.
Well, what kind of wages are we talking about?
Is it Lynn or Glenn?
Lynn, excuse me. What would a district court judge with, say, 8 years' experience be paid in the state of Alaska? Any idea? I mean, I'm just trying to get a handle on what, you know, 6 days would cost the state.
Well, the salary, you know, is set according to a certain level of the state classified employee salary, and I believe it's $67,000-some-odd. And it's more in places that are, I think Fairbanks has a cost of living increase. But it's the same. It's the same no matter how many years you've worked. It's just set to that place. But I'm not quite sure that it really costs the state more if you go on leave more, unless they have to bring in a pro tem judge to fill your place, because you're still getting paid, true, and you lose the productivity, true, but there's actually no additional salary paid to a judge because he's sick. But as I mentioned earlier, if a judge were sick for a lengthy period of time, then they have to cover, and there might be an additional cost for pro tem or acting judges.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I don't understand it then. What you're attempting to do is, right now, if you get ill, you have to take an annual leave day,
right,
in order to get paid for that day that you're sick.
Right.
Okay, what this legislation proposes is that you would no longer have to take that annual leave day to be paid for that day. You could take sick leave for that day. and you would still get paid, and you would not use up your annual leave, so when it came time for your annual vacation, you could still have your full vacation time there to take leave, or if you cashed out your leave at the end of your tenure, you could take the cash instead.
The point of the new system is that you can't accumulate leave. That would allow you to accumulate leave, and if you were allowed to do that indefinitely, it's true, at the time of your retirement or before, you might be able to cash out an enormous amount of leave. But because of the change in the system, you would only be able to accumulate 30 days, and that would be it. Now the district court judges can accumulate hundreds of days if they wish over the course of their service, and they're cashed out at the end of their time, but you can't accumulate under this bill more than 30 days. So I think that.
So you have to take your vacation every year, basically, or you lose it.
Right.
I think that's a good option. I think it's good to cash that out. These people, you know, put all this time in, and then they have like years of paid service. Could be up to a year.
Mr. Chairman.
No,
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Let me get this straight now. The Superior Court judges, Supreme Court judges, et cetera, have the system that you're talking about that you want to go on to, right?
Yes.
Do District Court judges get sick more than Superior Court judges?
No, actually, I think that...
I don't think they do either. I was just
statistics are a little less because District Court judges tend to be a little younger than Superior Court judges. I'm knocking on wood. But I don't think I've had more than a few days over the last 4 years.
Yeah, I guess that's the point. I don't see the great abuse here, but I'm...
Well, Mr. Chairman, how about magistrates? Do they get sick any less than district court judges?
Put magistrates under the system, then.
Well, maybe that's something we should look at. I mean, I really don't think, Mr. Chairman, that we've made a case here, at least they haven't convinced me, that there's that much difference between the service of a magistrate and a district court judge that we should exclude magistrates from that, those same benefits.
I don't have any hard... I don't, to tell you the truth, I don't care one way or the other. I just wanted to try to get off this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd say all the states, you know, the leave system is pretty lucrative for all the state employees. It's not just the judges and everybody else. I don't think we really should do anything by passing the bill or changing the judge. Although this is kind of nice because they have to take that leave every year and they don't carry it forward. And I can see where there's a lot of cases where people carry forward several years of leave.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to request that we hold this over until tomorrow's calendar so I could maybe work on a proposed committee substitute that might include magistrates. And see if I can get some idea from the court system if that would have any additional impact. It would still be a zero fiscal note, and present that to the committee tomorrow. And see what their thoughts on it are.
I have no objection to moving the bill for tomorrow.
I feel bad. I.
Okay. With that, we'll hold Senate Bill 285 for tomorrow's calendar. The next bill is 501.
Mr. Chairman.
We have Senator.
I moved the bill out.
Mr. Chairman,
what is it?
We're hearing here.
We have a motion to move out.
No,
Senator 501.
No, we.
Is this bill being heard in any other committee?
Yes.
No.
Yes, state affairs.
It's been waived.
Waived.
We have Randall Berg sign up to testify on Senate Bill 501. Mr. Byrne, could you join us?
Let's make a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Randall Burns, for the record, I'm Randall Burns, Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. Basically, this is a cleanup bill. Last year when currently, the division has two executive secretaries who are in the partially exempt service, the executive secretary to the nursing board and the executive secretary to the real estate commission are both executive secretary positions in the PX service. Last year, when the medical board went through its sunset and substantial changes were made to the medical board statute, the legislature passed statutory language giving the medical board an executive secretary as well as an investigator. Unfortunately, although the fiscal note that you all passed going along with the legislation assumed a partially exempt position, since we did not specifically amend AS 3925-120 to make it a partially exempt position, the administration is taking the position that we need to have this amendment, specific amendment, in order to do that. And for that reason, we have this bill is before you to accomplish that specific task. It would be very awkward to have two executive secretaries in the PX service and one in the classified service. And also, it would make it very difficult for the medical board to have the kind of control that it needs in that position. It's a very independent position, has a great deal of autonomy, and we were concerned that if we have the kind of disparity that this bill currently, that we currently have within the office, we would have a difficult administrative situation, and the board wouldn't have the kind of flexibility it needs with that position. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Are there any questions by members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ewing.
This is the only change we're making here.
That's correct. Just adding the sick.
We're not repealing anything out, or are we just repealing a letter out of there?
No, we're just adding.
Repealing J.
Just doing J.
No, we're repealing K.
L.
No. L
adding
is what
L.
the new one is.
But
is it
we're re-
that's what I was wondering. Was that repealing
the older Alaskan commissions?
Yeah, what are we doing there?
We're repealing K.
That's
yeah.
My point.
Well, that's because J becomes K is gone. Older Alaskan commissions becomes J, mental health board is K, and then L is
okay.
The state medical board.
What used to be J?
I have no idea, Mr. Chairman.
Doesn't matter.
I hope not.
Well, why was it there?
I have no idea.
Senator Hensley.
Mr. Chairman, are we ready? There was an objection to Senator Hensley's motion.
I would remake my motion.
Motion to move out Senate Bill 501, zero fiscal note. Other objections?
Mr. Chairman, can we just check real quick? Oh, okay, there was already repealed. There's no
repeal.
Okay,
yeah, it's okay.
Let's just clean up.
Without objection, 501, we've got a case of zero fiscal note. Somebody now to testify on sponsor substitute for House Bill 252, State Affairs Committee substitute.
Thank you.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Stout, and I'm representing the Division of Retirement and Benefits on 252. Basically, what 252 is to accomplish is to bring the supplemental benefits system into compliance with federal regulation. There has been a change in the Internal Revenue Code, which places the SVS system in a 401A type plan. And to comply with that, we have to break out the annuity portion of the system from the benefit portion of the system. So in essence, that's what this particular bill addresses. Is there any questions from the committee?
Any questions from the committee? The fiscal note is 475.8. And the breakdown of that looks like it's all administrative cost per system change. You see, 235 is salaries. That's the biggest chunk of it. I guess it's all data processing. And contractual, 66,000. The next biggest is consulting to make sure that it qualifies with IRS. I wonder if you just go through that fiscal note.
Certainly. Basically, when the supplemental benefit system was first established in 1980 or 81, the system was designed primarily to be almost 100% automated. With a major change like this, there is major program design that's necessary, and certainly current DP staff could not accommodate that without other assistance. So the personal services are for non-permanent programmers to come in and reprogram for this particular change, splitting out the two benefit packages, the annuity system and for the extra insurance. There will be, and certainly there's a lot of concern by various members participating in the supplemental benefit system, wanting to know just particularly how this change is going to affect them. So we're anticipating that we're going to need to have one person or the funds necessary to send one person into the field somewhat to discuss these various changes with the individuals. Mailing, responding to the extra correspondence for the questions, sending out information brochures to individuals.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Ewing.
I thought that was kind of interesting. You said you had to contact those people that are out there with the change that you're talking about. Are you talking about the employees who were hired after April 1st, 1986?
Well, generally, Senator, I think that the majority of the membership are very interested in the supplemental benefit system.
Right.
And we're going to get flooded with concerns from all members and not just those hired after any particular date. So I think that our target group is going to be all state employees and all employees of those participating municipalities.
Well, aren't you going to get flooded with concern no matter what we do, and probably get a lot more concerned if we don't do this bill? I'm wondering why it wasn't in the budget rather than in this fiscal note.
I guess I don't understand your the chair's question.
Well, when did the act pass?
The feds changed the tax law in 1986.
And we have to have this done by January 89?
That's correct.
And I assume there's a lot of insecurity about the whole issue of the SBS program having to be amended. And you're handling that level of input from the public anyway. Are you not?
The way the staffing is under the supplemental benefit system is that we have one staff person who's designated to handle inquiries, both telephone, and that person currently is not a traveling representative of the division. So, yes, we have the staff, but no, we don't have the money to send that person into the field to set up group meetings and talk to individuals. So I think that the theory is that we can talk to a group of people much easier than we can respond to 50 or 60 people contacting us either by phone or by letter. if we had the person on site in some of the various locations.
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry?
I'm trying to find the individual you're talking about in this fiscal note who is going to be doing that. Or are you just talking about the travel cost for that person to conduct employee meeting?
Yeah, I was responding to Senator Mueller's question, and I'm just going through it. I don't find the person either.
Because what I think you're finding, if you look through the backup, is there is a lot of concern by employees. Now, if you look through the backup in the bill, there is a lot of concern about employees. In fact, there was a survey done that was mailed out to all public employees by the commissioner of the administration, by the department administration, to get their opinion as to how they would like the new law structured as to, and that's a letter, there's a letter in your packet from the commissioner to Representative Omer, Chairman of the House State Affairs Committee, which indicates what the 13,923 surveys to SBS participants and what their reply was, and 84% wants the maximum annuity maintained, 6.13%, which is clearly reflected in that letter. There's an appendix attached there, which I think clearly reflects the level of interest out there, where it indicates that the division has already conducted employee meetings in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, 25 employee meetings, talking about what the change is and what's going on with the SBS system. So I don't see that they're requesting a new person to do that. They're requesting the travel funds to allow someone to get out there to do that. That's not a new person to conduct those types of informational meetings in a fiscal note that I can find anyway. The new people are to do the necessary program changes to be sure that the program is set up so it does comply with federal law, and also then $35,000 for consulting services to be sure that when we get this thing done, we're not out of step with IRS and don't end up with these benefits with the SBS program being subject to federal taxation initially. So that's what I think the fiscal note's about. But if you're asking the question, is there any interest, I think you only need to look at the backup to find out there's substantial interest.